Well, let's just imagine that you have just graduated from college, or you have just finished up your training at the tech school, or you've been accepted into an apprenticeship program, and you have just started your first real job. Okay, and so you are, you're a little bit apprehensive, you're humble, you know that there's a lot you need to learn, especially if you are desiring to rise up in the ranks and, improve yourself and become, a journeyman, or maybe be accepted as a partner, or be receive tenure as a professor, something like that, where you can get to the point where you feel like you have arrived. I have a friend down in Wisconsin. The company that he worked for when he was a little bit younger folded up, so all of a sudden he had to look for a job, and he accepted a job as a bank teller. Well, that was about 30 years ago, and about 2 months ago or so, he was named bank president of the branch down in Wisconsin. So he has risen up the ranks and he's achieved. Okay, but with success comes a lot of responsibility. Now, instead of trying to climb up the peak of that mountain with all these people around you, you're standing up there on the peak all alone. And there's everybody's eyes are on you, and it's a lot of stress, a lot of pressure. And the temptation there is to think, I've arrived, I've made it, I can call the shots, I'm in charge. And you begin to forget about the people that helped you rise to that rank. And a lot of times we forget about God. We think, I've done this, I can handle it. I don't need to be so subservient. I don't need to be asking God for directions anymore. And I'm afraid that that's what's happening with our friend King Saul. He started out very humble. When he was even first going to be his coronation as king, he was hiding, and they had to go look for him to bring him out. And then he relied on his friend Samuel. He looked to Samuel for advice, and Samuel was getting advice from God. So Saul was starting out quite strong. He achieved some amazing victories by trusting in the Lord. But now he's kind of been king for a while, and things have been sort of going his way. He's won some victories, but today we're going to find out how he handles that. We're going to be looking at 1 Samuel chapters 12 and 13 today. And in my Bible, chapter 12 is labeled Samuel's Farewell Address. I don't think it's really his farewell address. Samuel's going to be around for quite a while yet. So is Saul. I think it's more of, I'm going to wash my hands of this situation address. And he's just kind of telling the people, okay, I've tried my hardest. I have walked upright before you. In fact, if any of you have any complaint against me, if I've ever stolen your donkey or taking your ox or didn't ask for it, tell me now. Let me know if you have any complaint against me. And all the people with one voice said, no, you've been good, you're good. With God as our witness, you are blameless before us. You have tried your best. So after that, now Samuel then reminds the people about how God has led them. From the time that they were slaves in Egypt, how he provided Moses. Moses led them out of that captivity. He rescued them by the hand of the Lord. Then he also tells them about through the ages that whenever they got into dire situations, whenever they neglected the Lord and it led them into those dire situations, God provided a deliverer for them in the form of the judges. And even now, Samuel has been provided by God for the people of Israel to lead them and to instruct them. So in a sense, Samuel is saying to the people of Israel, has God ever let you down? Has God ever not been faithful? Has God ever stolen your donkey or your ox? And the people have to say, no, God has always been there for us. Even when we have turned away, God has still been there and he has taken steps to rescue us. So the people have to proclaim now, yes, you're right. God has been our faithful king. Yet, now the Israelites are faced with yet another situation. Nahash, as we talked about, the Ammonite, who wanted to gouge out all the people of Gibeah's right eye, was setting up a camp against the Israelites. And the Israelites were again in a panic and thinking, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Even though they've had Samuel, they've had the Lord, they forget both of those once again, and they cry out, we need a king, a military king, to protect us against these Ammonites. So God grants them their wish, and Samuel says to them, okay, you scoundrels, I'm going to give you a king. And so he sets them up with a king. And I think at this point, Samuel is washing his hands. He says, I have tried and tried to teach you, to lead you, but you keep turning away. You won't listen. You're stubborn. You want your own way. And so he is handing them over to their own desires. Nevertheless, even in this situation where the Israelites are once again turning their back on God, God tells them, Samuel tells them, that there is hope. There is always hope, and there is even hope for the rebellious. I'm going to read here in 1 Samuel chapter 12, verses 13 to 15 to start with. And this is Samuel talking to the people. Now here is the king that you have chosen, the one you have asked for. See, the Lord has set a king over you. But if you fear the Lord and serve and obey him and do not rebel against his commands, if both you and the king who reigns over you follow the Lord your God, good. But if you do not obey the Lord, if you rebel against his commands, his hand will be against you as it was against your ancestors. So even here now, in the midst of the people wanting to rebel, of them, in a sense, turning their back on God and turning it toward an earthly king, God is still working with his people. He's saying, okay, even in this situation, which is not ideal, but in this situation, if you will obey the Lord and if your king will obey the Lord, good. There is still hope for you. We are never without hope. Then continuing on in verses 20 and 22, we read this, and this is Samuel has just performed a sign for the people to prove to the people that God is still in control, and the people now are taken aback. They're in fear, realizing, oh, maybe what we did in asking for a king is not so good. So Samuel comforts them in a way with these words. Do not be afraid, Samuel replied. You have done all this evil in turning away from the Lord. Yet do not turn away from the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. Do not turn away after your useless idols. They can do you no good, nor can they rescue you because they are useless. For the sake of his great name, the Lord will not reject his people, because the Lord was pleased to make you his own. Okay, these words were first issued, of course, to the nation of Israel, which are the chosen people. God had chosen them out of the peoples of the earth to make his own and to set as an example through which he would work to eventually bring forth Jesus, the Messiah. So he is intent on working with these people, on molding these people. And so at times he brings upon them judgment. At times he brings upon them hard times to get their eyes to always turn back to the Lord. He's continually hopeful toward his people. He loves his people, and he wants them in turn to trust in him and to turn to him. Now, I think by inference, this also applies to the church. The church is now Jesus' bride, and the Lord is working with us to perfect us, to conform us to his image, to make us worthy of claiming Jesus as the bridegroom. And so he is also working with us, and he will continue to mold us and shape us, even if at times that means hardship or difficulty. The Lord is at work. But that should bring comfort to our hearts. That should bring a sense of peace and joy that the Lord has not given up on me. He loves me, and he is working with me. He wants us always to be turning to him, which is the definition of repentance. It is not so important what we turn away from, but what we turn toward. Because it is only turning toward Jesus that we have the strength to turn away from the things that would enslave us or trap us or in some way degrade our lives. In First Samuel then, chapter 13, we read that Saul has now been king for a while, and he has a son by the name of Jonathan who has grown to the point where he himself is a great warrior. So at this point, Saul has been king for 20, 30, maybe 40 years. And one day his son Jonathan now, who is an accomplished soldier, he takes the division of men that have been entrusted to him, a third of Saul's army, and he goes out and attacks a Philistine outpost. Okay, you remember the Philistines, kind of the arch enemy of the people of Israel. Well, Jonathan is successful in this attack, and he defeats this Philistine outpost. But what this had the effect of doing was definitely stirring up a hornet's nest of the Philistine nation. I don't know if I've told you the story before about the time where I thought that we could stomp on hornets faster than they could leave their hive. It happened to be a ground nest, and we thought, oh, no problem, we'll just... Well, we couldn't do that. And thankfully, at least thankfully for me, I was faster than my friend. And he was the one who received the brunt of it and was bit several times before he actually jumped off the dock into the lake. And he swelled up like a balloon. His hands were just huge. But that's what Jonathan is doing here. He has gone down. He says, oh, I think we can handle this. I think we can handle the Philistines. And he stomps on this one hive, but all he does, and he wins that little battle, but he starts a war. And the Philistines now, it says that when they considered the Israelites, they became a stench in their nostrils. They were odious. They were obnoxious to them because of what they had done in attacking this people. Now, the Philistines were a much more advanced group of people when it came to war than the Israelites were. They had chariots, they had horses, they had swords, they had spears. In the camp of the Israelites, only two people had swords and spears. That was Saul and Jonathan. Everybody else had clubs and pitchforks. And they were going to go out and fight this Philistine army. Many of the people began defecting. They actually crossed over and joined the Philistines. Others of them ran and hid in caves and in the woods. And even the men who stayed with Saul, the Bible tells us that they were quaking in fear. So Saul now is in a panic. What am I going to do? How am I going to quell this opposition? How am I going to fight against this huge army that has thousands of horses and thousands of chariots and we've got pitchforks and clubs. This is a lot like a major league team coming and playing the garden t-ball team. And you think, who's going to win? Who's going to win? Well, tune in next week to find out. Okay. So Saul is afraid. He himself is quaking in fear. He's taken his, and he, instead of beseeching an answer from the Lord, he takes his eyes off of God. And he allows his eyes to be filled up with fear, with pride, with impatience, and with empty religion. And these things get the best of Saul at this moment. Now, a precedent had been set back in chapter 10 when Saul was first anointed as king. And that precedent was that God is in control, that the prophet is his spokesman, and that the king is subservient to both of them. The king is to be subservient to God and his word, to the prophet, and then the king would be third in charge. But at this moment, Saul is thinking he's in charge. Let's read about this precedent back in, it's in 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 8. And this is Samuel talking to Saul. "Now go down ahead of me to Gilgal. I will surely come down to you and sacrifice burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. But you must wait 7 days until I come to you and tell you what you are to do." Okay, that is what Saul is, too many S names here. What Saul is supposed to do. He's supposed to wait, be waiting on Samuel to hear from the Lord. Okay, so now let's go back to chapter 13 and we'll read verses 7 to 14. And this is at the point where the Israelites, the Hebrews, are being struck by fear. It says some of them crossed the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead, which is where the Philistines had camped. These are the people who are defecting to go and join the Philistines because they think the Philistines are going to have a better chance at winning this war. But Saul remained at Gilgal, and all the troops with him were quaking with fear. He waited 7 days, the time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and Saul's men began to scatter. Even more people were starting to leave. So Saul, in a panic, says, "Bring me the burnt offering and the fellowship offering." And Saul offered up the burnt offering. Just as he finished making the offering, Samuel arrived, and Saul went out to greet him. "What have you done?" asked Samuel. Saul replied, "When I saw that the men were scattering and that you did not come at the set time and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, I thought, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal and I have not sought the Lord's favor. So I felt compelled to offer the burnt offering." "You have done a foolish thing," Samuel said. "You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you, which was to wait on the Lord. Wait until you had instructions from him. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command." That's a foreshadowing of the next king. It won't happen for several years yet. But it's a foreshadowing that God had chosen David already to replace Samuel, to replace Saul. Okay, so Saul here, in his impatience, in his fear, in his desire to take things into his own hands, makes the sacrifice, which was illegal for him to do as king. It was only to be performed by the priest, but it was not so much that, is that he was circumventing the command that the Lord has set up, the chain of command. He was placing himself above the prophet and, in a sense, placing himself above the word of the Lord and the Lord himself. He was taking things into his own hands. That is That is the command that he broke. It's the same command that Adam and Eve broke when they were in the Garden of Eden, that they didn't trust in the Lord and they trusted somebody else's word. They trusted themselves and did not trust in the Lord himself. Isaiah 1:11 says this about, in a sense, about Saul's sacrifice. The multitude of your sacrifice, what are they to me, says the Lord? I have more than enough of burnt offerings, of rams and the fat of fattened animals. I have no pleasure in the blood of bulls and lambs and goats. Empty religion, just doing things for the sake of checking off a box or feeling like I need to appease an angry God, is not at all what God is looking for. God is looking for a sacrifice from the heart. He's looking for a pure heart. It says that in Psalm 51:17, also talking about sacrifices and the blood of goats and rams. It says, the Lord, I don't want that. What I want is the sacrifice, O God. My sacrifice, O God, is a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. You, God, will not despise. That's what God is seeking. He is seeking us to trust him fully and unabashedly, no having to get there through jumping through hoops or doing sacrifices or this or that. The Lord simply wants you to trust him and his heart. Chapter 13 then ends with a little bit more description of how bleak the situation is. Verse 22, I did put it up. And this is the day of the battle. The battle is finally about to happen. So on the day of the battle, not a soldier with Saul and Jonathan had a sword or a spear in his hand. Only Saul and his son Jonathan had them. Okay, so this is the situation. Things are very bleak. But like I said, you'll have to tune in next week to get the conclusion of this story. But for now, I want to draw three insights from what we have already discussed in Samuel chapters 12 and 13. And the first one is, be careful what you ask for. Okay, and this, I think, in a large way applies to us in prayer. So we need to be careful what we ask for and how we ask for it. The book of Samuel started out with Hannah praying for a son. You remember that back several weeks ago? So Hannah is childless and she's being ridiculed. She's being tormented by her sister, wife, and she is praying desperately, Lord, please vindicate me, please give me a child, and if you give me that child, I will dedicate him back to you, and he will serve you all the days of his life. Well, that was Samuel, and when Samuel was weaned at the age of 3 or 4, only a couple more years to Lucas. Samuel was dedicated to the temple where he began serving even as a child in the temple. So her prayer was answered. Her prayer and her answer resulted, of course, in Samuel being born, but it also resulted in her being obedient, her being thankful, and it says her being filled with worship. She was so humble and so happy that the Lord took favor upon her that she could not help but worship. And we can read in the early part of the book of 1 Samuel her prayer of worship, her song of worship to the Lord. On the other hand, we have the nation of Israel also making a request. And their request was for a king. Now, the difference between these two requests was although Hannah's request certainly resulted in her being blessed, she prayed that the Lord might be honored. She prayed that the answer to her prayer might be a son devoted to the Lord. And it was not a selfish, not necessarily a totally selfish request. It was that the glory of God would be revealed. Whereas when Israel asked for a king, their request was totally selfish. Just give us a king so things will be better for us. And so often, we need to be careful in our prayers that we take into consideration the glory of God and the good of others, and not just pray selfishly. Now, having just said that, I'm going to tell you to pray about anything and everything. You know, take it to the Lord. If it is on your heart, it is on God's heart. And so pray about it. But add to that the fact who we are praying to, the great and glorious Father of the universe, the Creator, you know, filled with majesty, who we should stand before in awe, and it says, with the fear of the Lord. And we are asking Him, it is so gracious of Him to bend His ear toward us, but we need to realize who it is we are asking, and pray with His glory in mind and with the good of others in mind, and not just for our own comfort or for our own troubles to be alleviated. Although, I'm not saying you shouldn't pray for that. So, talking out of both sides of my mouth here, but remember who you are praying to. Remember that He is God. James 4:3 has a rebuke to the people who were not receiving answers to their prayers. He says, when you ask, you do not receive, because you ask with wrong motives, that you may spend what you get on your pleasures. They were praying only for their self-comfort, that their problems would be alleviated, not that the will of the Lord would be accomplished. So remember, we are to fear the Lord. We are to respect the Lord. C.S. Lewis said this, I am often, I believe, praying for others when I should be doing things for them. It is so much easier to pray for a boar than to go and see him. And I think it's the same way with us. Sometimes our prayers need to have feet, and we don't want to use prayer just as an excuse to say, I've taken care of a situation that we should, in fact, be taking care of with our own hands and feet. Second point I'd like to make from these couple of chapters is it's not over till it's over. Anybody know who originally said that?
Yogi Bear.
That's right. The great theologian Yogi Bear. Okay. But it's so true. In our lives, things today might not be going the way that we want them to go. But it's not over till it's over. And I especially think of this when I think of young people that I know, when I think of some of my own children, that it's not over until it's over, that the Lord can still do a work in their lives. Past failures do not guarantee future failures, but neither do past successes guarantee future successes. And this should be both an encouragement to us, but also bring home the need for continued diligence, that we cannot rest on our laurels, that just because we've been successful in the past guarantees our success for tomorrow. Each day brings new blessings and challenges of its own, and we need to be diligent each day. When the Greeks were first starting out their Olympic Games, there was one race that was called the Lampa de Phoria. And this is the race that today has been where they get the torch lighting ceremony at the beginning of the Olympics. The winner was not necessarily the runner who finished first, but it was the runner who finished with his torch still lit. And that's the thing that we want to do. We want to continue to run the race with our torch still lit. So we need to trim it, we need to fuel it, we need to keep that fire burning. In Matthew chapter 25, you don't have this one, Patty. there's the story of the 10 virgins, and they were waiting for the bridegroom to show up. Now, when I first read this, I thought, well, is this some sort of bachelorette story or what? But when you think about the 10 virgins, think bridesmaids, okay? So the bridesmaids now are waiting for the groom to show up so that the ceremony can begin, that they can begin to rejoice with the bride, that the bridegroom has come. So this says there were 10 of them, and it was getting late, so they had lamps, and the oil lamps, and they were waiting for the guy to show up, and he was delayed. So five of the ladies had their lamps burning, and they also had extra oil with them in case they needed to refuel their lamps. The other five did not have oil. They just had their lamps, and when their lamps went out, they asked the others, well, share with us some of your oil. They said, no, we can't. If we do that, then we won't have enough for ourselves. Go yourselves and buy more oil. So they went out and they found more oil. And by the time they found oil and came to the wedding feast, the doors had been shut and they were excluded. They weren't ready. They didn't persevere. They didn't take steps so that they would be ready when the time came. So we are encouraged to be ready, to store up for ourselves treasures in heaven. Now, Matthew 6, 19 and 20. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. So we need to persevere. We need to keep on keeping on. Norman Giesler, who is a Bible scholar, an apologist. He does several college campus debates where he debates atheists or people that have opposing views to Christianity. But as a child, and this is kind of fitting with our upcoming VBS, he went to a VBS because he was invited by some neighbor children. He went back to the same church for Sunday school then, for 400 Sundays. Each week he was faithfully picked up by a bus driver week after week as he attended church. But he never made a commitment to Christ. Finally, during his senior year in high school, after being picked up for church over 400 times, he did commit his life to Christ. What if the bus driver had given up on Giesler at 395? What if the bus driver had said, this kid is going nowhere spiritually. Why waste any more time on him? So the beginning of the story does not have to be the end of the story. It's not over till it's over. Consider that as you pray for those you know. Consider that in your own life as you are continually buffeted by one situation or another. Keep going. And then a third point is obedience, and not for the future, but for today. Be obedient today. Galatians 5, 13 to 16 gives us a picture of what that obedience might look like. And it might be something different than you think. You, my brothers and sisters, were called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge the flesh. Rather, serve one another humbly in love, for the entire law is filled up in keeping of this one command: love your neighbor as yourself. If you bite and devour each other, watch out, or you will be destroyed by each other. So I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. Being obedient to the Lord is showing love to the Lord and in showing love to each other, in serving each other. That's what it's all about. It is about love. Obedience today is what really matters. Brick by brick, we build the house, and it's day by day that we draw nearer to the Lord. Saul started out strong, but begins here to take his eyes off of God and to put them on situations and on himself. His impatience led to him taking things in his own hands, serving himself. Elizabeth Elliot, who was a missionary, also a Bible teacher, when she was speaking at a conference, she told of her young brother, Thomas. Their mother, when he was little, their mother used to let them play with the kitchen utensils in the kitchen. I don't know why it is, but